"What did you say to me?" His father's blue eyes widened. They were very bloodshot tonight. Jake guessed he had been dipping heavily into his supply of magic powder, and that probably made this a bad time to cross him. But Jake realized he intended to cross him just the same. He would not be shaken like a mouse in the jaws of a sadistic tomcat. Not tonight. Maybe not ever again. He suddenly realized that a large part of his anger stemmed from one simple fact. He could not talk to them about what had happened, what was still happening. They had closed all the doors. "But I have a key," he thought, and touched its shape through the fabric of his pants. And the rest of that strange verse occurred to him. "If you want to run and play, come along the beam today." "I said let go of me," he repeated. "I've got a sprained ankle and you're hurting it." "I'll hurt more than your ankle if you don't." Sudden strength seemed to flow into Jake. He seized the hand clamped on his arm just below the shoulder and shoved it violently away. His father's mouth dropped open. "I don't work for you," Jake said. "I'm your son, remember? If you forgot, check the picture on your desk." His father's upper lip pulled back from his perfectly capped teeth in a snarl that was two part surprise and one part fury. "Don't you talk to me like that, mister. Where in the hell is your respect?" "I don't know. Maybe I lost it on the way home." "You spend the whole goddamn day absent without leave, and then you stand there running your fat, disrespectful mouth—" "Stop it! Stop it, both of you!" Jake's mother cried. She sounded near tears in spite of the tranquilizers perking through her system. Jake's father reached for Jake's arm again, then changed his mind. The surprising force with which his son had torn his hand away a moment ago might have had something to do with it. Or perhaps it was only the look in Jake's eyes. "I want to know where you've been."
"Out. I told you that. And that's all I'm going to tell you."
"Fuck that. Your headmaster called. Your French teacher actually came here. And they both had buku questions for you." "So do I. And I want some answers."
"Your clothes are dirty," his mother observed, and then added timidly, "Were you mugged, Johnny? Did you play hooky and get mugged?"
"Of course he wasn't mugged," Elmer Chambers snarled. "Still wearing his watch, isn't he?"
"But there's blood on his head."
"It's okay, Mom. I just bumped it."
"But I'm going to bed. I'm very, very tired. If you want to talk about this in the morning, okay. Maybe we'll all be able to make some sense then. But for now, I don't have a thing to say."
His father took a step after him, reaching out.
"No, Elmer!"
Jake's mother almost screamed. Chambers ignored her. He grabbed Jake by the back of the blazer. "Don't you just walk away from me," he began, and then Jake whirled, tearing the blazer out of his hand. The seam under the right arm, already strained, let go with a rough purring sound. His father saw those blazing eyes and stepped away. The rage on his face was doused by something that looked like terror. That blaze was not metaphorical. Jake's eyes actually seemed to be on fire. His mother gave voice to a strengthless little scream, clapped one hand to her mouth, took two large, stumbling steps backward, and dropped into a rocking chair with a small thud.
"Leave me alone," Jake said.
"What's happened to you?" his father asked, and now his tone was almost plaintive. "What in the hell's happened to you? You bug out of school without a word to anyone on the first day of exams, you come back filthy from head to toe, and you act as if you've gone crazy." Well, there it was. You act as if you've gone crazy. What he'd been afraid of ever since the voices started 3 weeks ago, the dread accusation. Only now that it was out, Jake found it didn't frighten him much at all. Perhaps because he had finally put the issue to rest in his own mind. Yes, something had happened to him, was still happening. But no, he had not gone crazy. At least not yet. "We'll talk about it in the morning," he repeated. He walked across the dining room, and this time his father didn't try to stop him. He had almost reached the hall when his mother's voice, worried, stopped him.
"Johnny, are you all right?"
And what should he answer? Yes? No?
Both of the above? Neither of the above? But the voices had stopped. And that was something. That was, in fact, quite a lot. Better, he said at last. He went down to his room and closed the door firmly behind him. The sound of the door snicking firmly shut between him and all the rest of the round world filled him with tremendous relief. 20. He stood by the door for a little while, listening. His mother's voice was only a murmur, his father's voice a little louder. His mother said something about blood and a doctor. His father said the kid was fine, the only thing wrong with the kid was the junk coming out of his mouth, and he would fix that. His mother said something about calming down. His father said he was calm. His mother said, he said, she said, blah, blah, blah. Jake still loved them. He was pretty sure he did, anyway. But other stuff had happened now, and these things had made it necessary that still other things must occur. Why? Because something was wrong with the rose. And maybe because he wanted to run and play, and see his eyes again, as blue as the sky above the way station had been. Jake walked slowly over to his desk, removing his blazer as he went. It was pretty wasted, one sleeve torn almost completely off, the lining hanging like a limp sail. He slung it over the back of his chair, then sat down and put the books on his desk. He had been sleeping very badly over the last week and a half, but he thought tonight he would sleep well. He couldn't remember ever being so tired. When he woke up in the morning, perhaps he would know what to do. There was a light knock at the door, and Jake turned warily in that direction. "It's Mrs. Shaw, John. May I come in for a minute?" He smiled. Mrs. Shaw. Of course it was. His parents had drafted her as an intermediary. Or perhaps translator might be a better word. "You go see him," his mother would have said. "He'll tell you what's wrong with him. I'm his mother, and this man with the bloodshot eyes and the runny nose is his father, and you're only the housekeeper. But he'll tell you what he wouldn't tell us, because you see more of him than either of us, and maybe you speak his language." She'll have a tray, Jake thought. And when he opened the door, he was smiling. Mrs. Shaw did indeed have a tray. There were two sandwiches on it, a wedge of apple pie, and a glass of chocolate milk. She was looking at Jake with mild anxiety, as if she thought he might lunge forward and try to bite her. Jake looked over her shoulder, but there was no sign of his parents. He imagined them sitting in the living room, listening anxiously. "I thought you might like something to eat," Mrs. Shaw said. "Yes, thanks." In fact, he was ravenously hungry. He hadn't eaten since breakfast. He stood aside, and Mrs. Shaw came in, giving him another apprehensive look as she passed, and put the tray on the desk. "Oh, look at this," she said, picking up Charlie the Choo-Choo. "I had this one when I was a little girl. Did you buy this today, Johnny?" "Yes." "Did my parents ask you to find out what I'd been up to?" She nodded. No acting, no put-on. It was just a chore, like taking out the trash. "You can tell me if you want to," her face said, "or you can keep still. I like you, Johnny, but it's really nothing to me, one way or the other. I just work here, and it's already an hour past my regular quitting time." He was not offended by what her face had to say. On the contrary, he was further calmed by it. Mrs. Shaw was another acquaintance who was not quite a friend, but he thought she might be a little closer to a friend than any of the kids at school were, and much closer than either his mother or father. Mrs. Shaw was honest, at least. She didn't dance. It all went on the bill at the end of the month, and she always cut the crusts off the sandwiches. Jake picked up a sandwich and took a large bite. Bologna and cheese, his favorite. That was another thing in Mrs. Shaw's favor. She knew all his favorites. His mother was still under the impression that he liked corn on the cob and hated Brussels sprouts. "Please tell them I'm fine," he said. "And tell my father I'm sorry that I was rude to him." He wasn't, but all his father really wanted was that apology. Once Mrs. Shaw conveyed it to him, he would relax and begin to tell himself the old lie. He had done his fatherly duty and all was well. All was well and all manner of things were well. I've been studying very hard for my exams, he said, chewing as he talked. And it all came down on me this morning, I guess. I sort of froze. It seemed like I had to get out or I'd suffocate. He touched the dried crust of blood on his forehead. As for this, please tell my mother it's really nothing. I didn't get mugged or anything. It was just a stupid accident. There was a UPS guy pushing a hand truck, and I walked right into it. The cut's no big deal. I'm not having double vision or anything, and even the headache's gone now. She nodded. I can see how it must have been, a high-powered school like that and all. You just got a little spooked. No shame in that, Johnny. But you really haven't seemed like yourself this last couple of weeks. I think I'll be okay now. I might have to redo my final essay in English, but oh, Mrs. Shaw said. A startled look crossed her face. She put Charlie the Choo-Choo back down on Jake's desk. I almost forgot. Your French teacher left something for you. I'll just get it. She left the room. Jake hoped he hadn't worried Mr. Bissette, who was a pretty good guy, but he supposed he must have since Bissette had actually made a personal appearance. Jake had an idea that personal appearances were pretty rare for Piper school teachers. He wondered what Mr. Bissette had left. His best guess was an invitation to talk with Mr. Hotchkiss, the school shrink. That would have scared him this morning, but not tonight. Tonight only the rose seemed to matter. He tore into his second sandwich. Mrs. Shaw had left the door open, and he could hear her talking with his parents. They both sounded a little more cooled out now. Jake drank his milk, then grabbed the plate with the apple pie on it. A few moments later, Mrs. Shaw came back. She was carrying a very familiar blue folder. Jake found that not all of his dread had left him after all. They would all know by now, of course, students and faculty alike, and it was too late to do anything about it. But that didn't mean he liked all of them knowing he had flipped his lid, that they were talking about him. A small envelope had been paper-clipped to the front of the folder. Jake pulled it free and looked up at Mrs. Shaw as he opened it. "How are my folks doing now?" he asked. She allowed herself a brief smile. "Your father wanted me to ask why you didn't just tell him you had exam fever. He said he had it himself once or twice when he was a boy." Jake was struck by this. His father had never been the sort of man to indulge in reminiscences which began, "You know, when I was a kid..." Jake tried to imagine his father as a boy with a bad case of exam fever and found he couldn't quite do it. The best he could manage was the unpleasant image of a pugnacious dwarf in a Piper sweatshirt, a dwarf in custom-tooled cowboy boots, a dwarf with short black hair bolting up from his forehead. The note was from Mr. Bissette. "Dear John, Bonnie Avery told me that you left early. She's very concerned about you, and so am I. Although we have both seen this sort of thing before, especially during exam week. Please come and see me first thing tomorrow, okay? Any problems you have can be worked out. If you're feeling pressured by exams, and I want to repeat that it happens all the time, a postponement can be arranged. Our first concern is your welfare. Call me this evening if you like. You can reach me at 555-7661. I'll be up until midnight. Remember that we all like you very much, and are on your side. A votre sante, Len Bissette." Jake felt like crying. The concern was stated, and that was wonderful. But there were other things, unstated things in the note, that were even more wonderful. Warmth, caring, and an effort, however misconceived, to understand and console. Mr. Bissette had drawn a small arrow at the bottom of the note. Jake turned it over and read this. "By the way, Bonnie asked me to send this along. Congratulations." Congratulations? What in the hell did that mean? He flipped open the folder. A sheet of paper had been clipped to the first page of his final essay. It was headed "From the Desk of Benita Avery," and Jake read the spiky fountain-penned lines with growing amazement. "John, Leonard will undoubtedly voice the concern we all feel. He is awfully good at that, so let me confine myself to your final essay, which I read and graded during my free period. It is stunningly original and superior to any student work I have read in the last few years. Your use of incremental repetition, and that is the truth, is inspired, But of course, incremental repetition is really just a trick. The real worth of the composition is in its symbolic quality, first stated by the images of the train and the door on the title page, and carried through splendidly within. This reaches its logical conclusion with the picture of the Black Tower, which I take as your statement that conventional ambitions are not only false, but dangerous. I do not pretend to understand all the symbolism, e.g. Lady of Shadows, Gunslinger, but it seems clear that you yourself are the prisoner of school, society, etc., and that the educational system is the speaking demon. Is it possible that both Roland and the Gunslinger are the same authority figure? Your father, perhaps? I became so intrigued by this possibility that I looked up his name in your records. I note it is Elmer, but I further note that his middle initial is R. I find this extremely provocative. Or is this name a double symbol, drawn both from your father and from Robert Browning's poem, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came? This is not a question I would ask most students, but of course I know how omnivorously you read. At any rate, I am extremely impressed. Younger students are often attracted to so-called stream-of-consciousness writing, but are rarely able to control it. You have done an outstanding job of merging S of C with symbolic language. Bravo! Drop by as soon as you're back at it. I want to discuss possible publication of this piece in the first issue of next year's student literary magazine. B. Avery. P.S. If you left school today because you had sudden doubts about my ability to understand a final essay of such unexpected richness, I hope I have assuaged them. Jake pulled the sheet off the clip, revealing the title page of his stunningly original and richly symbolic final essay. Written and circled there in the red ink of Ms. Avery's marking pen was the notation A+. Below this she had written, "Excellent job." Jake began to laugh. The whole day, the long, scary, confusing, exhilarating, terrifying, mysterious day, was condensed in great, roaring sobs of laughter. He slumped in his chair, head thrown back, hands clutching his belly, tears streaming down his face. He laughed himself hoarse. He would almost stop, and then some line from Ms. Avery's well-meaning critique would catch his eye, and he would be off to the races again. He didn't see his father come to the door, look in at him with puzzled, wary eyes, and then leave again, shaking his head. At last he did become aware that Mrs. Shaw was still sitting on his bed, looking at him with an expression of friendly detachment, tinctured with faint curiosity. He tried to speak, but the laughter pealed out again before he could. "I gotta stop," he thought. "I gotta stop or it's gonna kill me. I'll have a stroke or a heart attack or something." Then he thought, "I wonder what she made of choo-choo, choo-choo," and he began to laugh wildly again. At last the spasms began to taper off to giggles. He wiped his arm across his streaming eyes and said, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Shaw. It's just that, well, I got an A+ on my final essay. It was all very, very rich and very sim... But he couldn't finish. He doubled up with laughter again, holding his throbbing belly. Mrs. Shaw got up, smiling. "That's very nice, John. I'm happy it's all turned out so well, and I'm sure your folks will be, too. I'm awfully late. I think I'll ask the doorman to call me a cab. Good night, and sleep well." "Good night, Mrs. Shaw," Jake said, controlling himself with an effort. "And thanks." As soon as she was gone, he began to laugh again. 21. During the next half hour, he had separate visits from both parents. They had indeed calmed down, and the A-plus grade on Jake's final essay seemed to calm them further. Jake received them with his French text open on the desk before him, but he hadn't really looked at it, nor did he have any intention of looking at it. He was only waiting for them to be gone so he could study the two books he had bought earlier that day. He had an idea that the real final exams were still waiting just over the horizon, and he wanted desperately to pass. His father poked his head into Jake's room around 9:45, about 20 minutes after Jake's mother had concluded her own short, vague visit. Elmer Chambers was holding a cigarette in one hand and a glass of scotch in the other. He seemed not only calmer, but almost zonked. Jake wondered briefly and indifferently if he'd been hitting his mother's Valium supply.
"Are you okay, kid?"
"Yes." He was once again the small, neat boy who was always completely in control of himself. The eyes he turned to his father were not blazing, but opaque.
"I wanted to say, I'm sorry about before."
His father was not a man who made many apologies, and he did it badly. Jake found himself feeling a little sorry for him.
"It's all right."
"Hard day," his father said.
He gestured with the empty glass.
"Why don't we just forget it happened?"
He spoke as if this great and logical idea had just come to him.
"I already have."
"Good."
His father sounded relieved.
"Time for you to get some sleep, isn't it? You'll have some explaining to do and some tests to take tomorrow."
"I guess so," Jake said. "Is Mom okay?"
"Fine, fine. I'm going in the study. Got a lot of paperwork tonight."
"Dad?"
His father looked back at him warily.
"What's your middle name?"
Something in his father's face told Jake that he had looked at the final essay grade, but hadn't bothered to read either the paper itself or Ms. Avery's critique.
"I don't have one," he said. "Just an initial, like Harry S. Truman, except mine's an R. What brought that on?"
"Just curious," Jake said.
He managed to hold on to his composure until his father was gone, but as soon as the door was closed, he ran to his bed and stuffed his face into his pillow to muffle another bout of wild laughter. 22. When he was sure he was over the current fit, although an occasional snicker still rumbled up his throat like an aftershock, and his father would be safely locked away in his study with his cigarettes, his scotch, his papers, and his little bottle of white powder, Jake went back to his desk, turned on the study lamp, and opened Charlie the Choo-Choo. He glanced briefly at the copyright page and saw it had originally been published in 1942. His copy was from the fourth printing. He looked at the back, but there was no information at all about Beryl Evans, the book's author. Jake turned back to the beginning, looked at the picture of a grinning, blonde-haired man sitting in the cab of a steam locomotive, considered the proud grin on the man's face, and then began to read. Bob Brooks was an engineer for the Mid-World Railway Company on the St. Louis to Topeka run. Engineer Bob was the best train man the Mid-World Railway Company ever had, and Charlie was the best train. Charlie was a 402 big boy steam locomotive, and Engineer Bob was the only man who had ever been allowed to sit in his peak seat and pull the whistle. Everyone knew the woo of Charlie's whistle, and whenever they heard it echoing across the flat Kansas countryside, they said, "There goes Charlie and Engineer Bob, the fastest team between St. Louis and Topeka." Boys and girls ran into their yards to watch Charlie and Engineer Bob go by. Engineer Bob would smile and wave. The children would smile and wave back. Engineer Bob had a special secret. He was the only one who knew. Charlie the Choo-Choo was really, really alive. One day, while they were making the run between Topeka and St. Louis, Engineer Bob heard singing. Very soft and low. "Who is in the cab with me?" Engineer Bob said sternly.
"You need to see a shrink, Engineer Bob," Jake murmured and turned the page.
Here was a picture of Bob bending over to look beneath Charlie the Choo-Choo's automatic firebox. Jake wondered who was driving the train and watching out for cows, not to mention boys and girls on the tracks, while Bob was checking for stowaways, and guessed that Beryl Evans hadn't known a lot about trains.
"Don't worry," said a small, gruff voice. "It is only I."
"Who's I?" Engineer Bob asked.
He spoke in his biggest, sternest voice, because he still thought someone was playing a joke on him.
"Charlie," said the small, gruff voice.
"Hardy har har," said Engineer Bob. "Trains can't talk." I may not know much, but I know that. If you're Charlie, I suppose you can blow your own whistle.
Of course, said the small, gruff voice,
and just then the whistle made its big noise, rolling out across the Missouri plains.
Woo-woo! Goodness, said Engineer Bob, it really is you.
I told you, said Charlie the Choo-Choo.
How come I never knew you were alive before? Asked Engineer Bob. Why didn't you ever talk to me before?
Then Charlie sang this song to Engineer Bob in his small, gruff voice.
Don't ask me silly questions, I won't play silly games. I'm just a simple choo-choo train, and I'll always be the same. I only want to race along beneath the bright blue sky, and be a happy choo-choo train until the day I die.
Will you talk to me some more when we're making our run? Asked Engineer Bob. I'd like that.
I would too, said Charlie. I love you, Engineer Bob.
I love you too, Charlie, said Engineer Bob. And then he blew the whistle himself, just to show how happy he was.
Woo!
It was the biggest and best Charlie had ever whistled, and everyone who heard it came out to see. The picture which illustrated this last was similar to the one on the cover of the book. In the previous pictures, they were rough drawings which reminded Jake of the pictures in his favorite kindergarten book, Mike Mulligan and His Steam Shovel. The locomotive had been just a locomotive. Cheery, undoubtedly interesting to the 40s-era boys who had been this book's intended audience, but still only a piece of machinery. In this picture, however, it had clearly human features, and this gave Jake a deep chill, despite Charlie's smile and the rather heavy-handed cuteness of the story. He didn't trust that smile. He turned to his final essay and scanned down the lines. I'm pretty sure Blaine is dangerous, he read, and that is the truth. He closed the folder, tapped his fingers on it thoughtfully for a few moments, then returned to Charlie the Choo-Choo. Engineer Bob and Charlie spent many happy days together and talked of many things. Engineer Bob lived alone, and Charlie was the first real friend he'd had since his wife died long ago in New York. Then one day, when Charlie and Engineer Bob returned to the roundhouse in St. Louis, they found a new diesel locomotive in Charlie's berth. And what a diesel locomotive it was! 5,000 horsepower, stainless steel couplers, traction motors from the Utica Engine Works in Utica, New York, and sitting on top behind the generator were three bright yellow radiator cooling fans. What is this? Engineer Bob asked in a worried voice, but Charlie only sang his song in his smallest, gruffest voice.
Don't ask me silly questions, I won't play silly games. I'm just a simple choo-choo train and I'll always be the same. I only want to race along beneath the bright blue sky and be a happy choo-choo train until the day I die.
Mr. Briggs, the roundhouse manager, came over. That is a beautiful diesel locomotive, said Engineer Bob, but you will have to move it out of Charlie's berth, Mr. Briggs. Charlie needs a lube job this very afternoon.
Charlie won't be needing any more lube jobs, Engineer Bob, said Mr. Briggs sadly. This is his replacement, a brand new Burlington Zephyr diesel loco. Once Charlie was the best locomotive in the world, but now he is old and his boiler leaks. I'm afraid the time has come for Charlie to retire.
Nonsense! Engineer Bob was mad. Charlie is still full of zip and zowie. I will telegraph the head office of the Midworld Railway Company. I will telegraph the president, Mr. Raymond Martin, myself. I know him because he once gave me a good service award, and afterwards Charlie and I took his little daughter for a ride. I let her pull the lanyard, and Charlie whistled his loudest for her.
I am sorry, Bob, said Mr. Briggs, but it was Mr. Martin himself who ordered the new diesel loco.
It was true. And so Charlie the Choo-Choo was shunted off to a siding in the furthest corner of Midworld St. Louis Yard to rust in the weeds. Now the honk-honk of the Burlington Zephyr was heard on the St. Louis to Topeka run, and Charlie's blew no more.
A family of mice nested in the seat where Engineer Bob once sat so proudly, watching the countryside speed past. A family of swallows nested in his smokestack. Charlie was lonely and very sad. He missed the steel tracks and bright blue skies and wide open spaces. Sometimes, late at night, he thought of these things and cried dark, oily tears. This rusted his fine Stratum headlight, but he didn't care, because now the Stratum headlight was old and it was always dark. Mr. Martin, the president of the Midworld Railway Company, wrote and offered to put Engineer Bob in the peak seat of the new Burlington Zephyr. "It is a fine loco, Engineer Bob," said Mr. Martin, "chock full of zip and zowie, and you should be the one to pilot it. Of all the engineers who work for Midworld, you are the best. And my daughter Susanna has never forgotten that you let her pull old Charlie's whistle." But Engineer Bob said that if he couldn't pilot Charlie, his days as a trainman were done. "I wouldn't understand such a fine new diesel loco," said Engineer Bob, "and it wouldn't understand me." He was given a job cleaning the engines in the St. Louis yards, and Engineer Bob became Wiper Bob. Sometimes the other engineers who drove the fine new diesels would laugh at him. "Look at that old fool," they said. "He cannot understand that the world has moved on." Sometimes, late at night, Engineer Bob would go to the far side of the rail yard, where Charlie the Choo-Choo stood on the rusty rails of the lonely siding which had become his home. Weeds had twined in his wheels, his headlight was rusty and dark. Engineer Bob always talked to Charlie, but Charlie replied less and less. Many nights he would not talk at all. One night, a terrible idea came into Engineer Bob's head. "Charlie, are you dying?" he asked. And in his smallest, gruffest voice, Charlie replied,
"Don't ask me silly questions. I won't play silly games. I'm just a simple choo-choo train, and I'll always be the same. Now that I can't race along beneath the bright blue sky, I guess that I'll just sit right here until I finally die."
Jake looked at the picture accompanying this not exactly unexpected turn of events for a long time. Rough drawing it might be, but it was still definitely a three-handkerchief job. Charlie looked old, beaten, and forgotten. Engineer Bob looked like he had lost his last friend, which, according to the story, he had. Jake could imagine children all over America blatting their heads off at this point, and it occurred to him that there were a lot of stories for kids with stuff like this in them, stuff that threw acid all over your emotions. Hansel and Gretel being turned out into the forest, Bambi's mother getting scragged by a hunter, the death of Old Yeller. It was easy to hurt little kids, easy to make them cry, and this seemed to bring out a strangely sadistic streak in many storytellers, including, it seemed, Beryl Evans. But Jake found he was not saddened by Charlie's relegation to the weedy wastelands at the outer edge of the Midworld train yards in St. Louis. Quite the opposite. "Good," he thought. "That's the place for him. That's the place, because he's dangerous. Let him rot there, and don't trust that tear in his eye. They say crocodiles cry, too." He read the rest rapidly. It had a happy ending, of course, although it was undoubtedly that moment of despair on the edge of the train yards which children remembered long after the happy ending had slipped their minds. Mr. Martin, the president of the Midworld Railway Company, came to St. Louis to check on the operation. His plan was to ride the Burlington Zephyr to Topeka, where his daughter was giving her first piano recital that very afternoon. Only the Zephyr wouldn't start. There was water in the diesel fuel, it seemed. "Were you the one who watered the diesel, Engineer Bob?" Jake wondered. "I bet it was, you sly dog, you." All the other trains were out on their runs. What to do? Someone tugged Mr. Martin's arm. It was Wiper Bob, only he no longer looked like an engine wiper. He had taken off his oil-stained dungarees and put on a clean pair of overalls. On his head was his old pillow-tick engineer's cap. "Charlie is right over there on that siding," he said. "Charlie will make the run to Topeka, Mr. Martin. Charlie will get you there in time for your daughter's piano recital."
"That old steamer," scoffed Mr. Briggs. "Charlie would still be 50 miles out of Topeka at sundown."
"Charlie can do it," Engineer Bob insisted. "Without a train to pull, I know he can. I've been cleaning his engine and his boiler in my spare time, you see."
"We'll give it a try," said Mr. Martin. "I would be sorry to miss Susanna's first recital."
Charlie was all ready to go. Engineer Bob had filled his tender with fresh coal, and the firebox was so hot its sides were red. He helped Mr. Martin up into the cab and backed Charlie off the rusty, forgotten siding and onto the main track for the first time in years. Then, as he engaged forward first, he pulled on the lanyard, and Charlie gave his old brave cry. "Woo-woo!" All over St. Louis, the children heard that cry and ran out into their yards to watch the rusty old steam loco pass. "Look," they cried, "it's Charlie! Charlie the Choo-Choo is back! Hurrah!" They all waved, and as Charlie steamed out of town, gathering speed, he blew his own whistle, just as he had in the old days. "Woo-woo!" Clickety-clack went Charlie's wheels. Chuffa-chuffa went the smoke from Charlie's stack. Brump-brump went the conveyor as it fed coal into the firebox. Talk about zip! Talk about zowie! Golly, gee, gosh, and wowie! Charlie had never gone so fast before. The countryside went whizzing by in a blur. They passed the cars on Route 41 as if they were standing still.
"Hop-tee-doodle!" cried Mr. Martin, waving his hat in the air. "This is some locomotive, Bob. I don't know why we ever retired it. How do you keep the coal conveyor loaded at this speed?"
Engineer Bob only smiled because he knew Charlie was feeding himself. And beneath the clickety-clack and the chuffa-chuffa and the brump-brump, he could hear Charlie singing his old song in his low, gruff voice.
"Don't ask me silly questions. I won't play silly games. I'm just a simple choo-choo train, and I'll always be the same. I only want to race along beneath the bright blue sky and be a happy choo-choo train until the day I die."
Charlie got Mr. Martin to his daughter's piano recital on time, of course, and Susanna was just tickled pink to see her old friend Charlie again, of course, and they all went back to St. Louis together with Susanna yanking hell out of the train whistle the whole way. Mr. Martin got Charlie and Engineer Bob a gig pulling kids around the brand-new Mid-World Amusement Park and Fun Fair in California, and you will find them there to this day, pulling laughing children hither and thither in that world of lights and music and good, wholesome fun. Engineer Bob's hair is white, and Charlie doesn't talk as much as he once did. But both of them still have plenty of zip and zowie, and every now and then, the children hear Charlie singing his old song in his soft, gruff voice. The end. "Don't ask me silly questions. I won't play silly games," Jake muttered, looking at the final picture. It showed Charlie the Choo-Choo pulling two bunting-decked passenger cars filled with happy children from the roller coaster to the Ferris wheel. Engineer Bob sat in the cab, pulling the whistle cord and looking as happy as a pig in shit. Jake supposed Engineer Bob's smile was supposed to convey supreme happiness, but to him it looked like the grin of a lunatic. Charlie and Engineer Bob both looked like lunatics. And the more Jake looked at the kids, the more he thought that their expressions looked like grimaces of terror. "Let us off this train," those faces seemed to say. "Please, just let us off this train alive. And be a happy choo-choo train until the day I die." Jake closed the book and looked at it thoughtfully. Then he opened it again and began to leaf through the pages, circling certain words and phrases that seemed to call out to him. The Mid-World Railway Company. Engineer Bob. A small, gruff voice. Woo-woo! The first real friend he'd had since his wife died long ago in New York. Mr. Martin. The world has moved on. Susanna. He put his pen down. Why did these words and phrases call to him?
The one about New York seemed obvious enough, but what about the others? For that matter, why this book? That he had been meant to buy it was beyond question. If he hadn't had the money in his pocket, he felt sure he would have simply grabbed it and bolted from the store. But why? He felt like a compass needle. The needle knows nothing about magnetic north. It only knows it must point in a certain direction, like it or not. The only thing Jake knew for sure was that he was very, very tired. And if he didn't crawl into bed soon, he was going to fall asleep at his desk. He took off his shirt, then gazed down at the front of Charlie the Choo-Choo again. That smile. He just didn't trust that smile. Not a bit. 23. Sleep didn't come as soon as Jake had hoped. The voices began to argue again about whether he was alive or dead, and they kept him awake. At last he sat up in bed with his eyes closed and his fisted hands planted against his temples. "Quit!" he screamed at them. "Just quit! You were gone all day. Be gone again!" "I would if he'd just admit I'm dead," one of the voices said sulkily. "I would if he'd just take a for God's sake look around and admit I'm clearly alive," the other snapped back. He was going to scream right out loud. There was no way to hold it back. He could feel it coming up his throat like vomit. He opened his eyes, saw his pants lying over the seat of his desk chair, and an idea occurred to him. He got out of bed, went to the chair, and felt in the right front pocket of the pants. The silver key was still there, and the moment his fingers closed around it, the voices ceased. "Tell him," he thought, with no idea who the thought was for. "Tell him to grab the key. The key makes the voices go." He went back to bed and was asleep with the key clasped loosely in his hand 3 minutes after his head hit the pillow. 3. Door and Demon. 1. Eddie was almost asleep when a voice spoke clearly in his ear. "Tell him to grab the key. The key makes the voices go." He sat bolt upright, looking around wildly. Susanna was sound asleep beside him. That voice had not been hers. Nor anyone else's, it seemed. They'd been moving through the woods and along the path of the beam for 8 days now, and this evening they had camped in the deep cleft of a pocket valley. Close by, on the left, a large stream roared brashly past, headed in the same direction as they were, southeast. To the right, firs rose up a steep slope of land. There were no intruders here, only Susanna asleep and Roland awake. He sat huddled beneath his blanket at the edge of the stream's cut, staring out into the darkness. "Tell him to grab the key. The key makes the voices go." Eddie hesitated for only a moment. Roland's sanity was in the balance now. The balance was tipping the wrong way, and the worst part of it was this. No one knew it better than the man himself. At this point, Eddie was prepared to clutch at any straw. He had been using a folded square of deerskin as a pillow. He reached beneath it and removed a bundle wrapped in a piece of hide. He walked over to Roland and was disturbed to see that the gunslinger did not notice him until he was less than 4 steps from his unprotected back. There had been a time, and it was not so long ago, when Roland would have known Eddie was awake even before Eddie sat up. He would have heard the change in his breathing. "He was more alert than this back on the beach when he was half dead from the lobster thing's bite," Eddie thought grimly. Roland at last turned his head and glanced at him. His eyes were bright with pain and weariness, but Eddie recognized these things as no more than a surface glitter. Beneath it, he sensed a growing confusion that would almost surely become madness if it continued to develop unchecked. Pity tugged at Eddie's heart. "Can't sleep?" Roland asked. His voice was slow, almost drugged. "I almost was, and then I woke up," Eddie said. "Listen, I think I'm getting ready to die." Roland looked at Eddie. The bright shine left his eyes.
and now looking into them was like staring into a pair of deep, dark wells that seemed to have no bottom. Eddie shuddered, more because of that empty stare than because of what Roland had said. "And do you know what I hope lies in the clearing where the path ends, Eddie?" "Roland, silence," Roland said. He exhaled a dusty sigh. "Just silence. That will be enough. An end to this." He planted his fists against his temples, and Eddie thought, "I've seen someone else do that, and not long ago." "But who? Where?" It was ridiculous, of course. He had seen no one but Roland and Susanna for almost 2 months now. But it felt true all the same. "Roland, I've been making something," Eddie said. Roland nodded. A ghost of a smile touched his lips. "I know. What is it? Are you finally ready to tell?" "I think it might be part of this quartet thing." The vacant look left Roland's eyes. He gazed at Eddie thoughtfully but said nothing. "Look." Eddie began to unfold the piece of hide. "That won't do any good," Henry's voice suddenly brayed. It was so loud that Eddie actually flinched a little. "It's just a stupid piece of wood carving. He'll take one look and laugh at it. He'll laugh at you. Oh, look at this," he'll say. "Did the sissy carve something?" "Shut up," Eddie muttered. The gunslinger raised his eyebrows. "Not you." Roland nodded, unsurprised. "Your brother comes to you often, doesn't he, Eddie?" For a moment, Eddie only stared at him, his carving still hidden in the hide square. Then he smiled. It was not a very pleasant smile. "Not as often as he used to, Roland. Thank Christ for small favors." "Yes," Roland said. "Too many voices weigh heavy on a man's heart. What is it, Eddie? Show me, please." Eddie held up the chunk of ash. The key, almost complete, emerged from it like the head of a woman from the prow of a sailing ship, or the hilt of a sword from a chunk of stone. Eddie didn't know how close he had come to duplicating the key shape he had seen in the fire, and never would, he supposed, unless he found the right lock in which to try it. But he thought it was close. Of one thing he was quite sure. It was the best carving he had ever done, by far. "By the gods, Eddie, it's beautiful," Roland said. The apathy was gone from his voice. He spoke in a tone of surprised reverence Eddie had never heard before. "Is it done?" "It's not, is it?" "No, not quite." He ran his thumb into the third notch, and then over the S-shape at the end of the last notch. "There's a little more to do on this notch, and the curve at the end isn't right yet. I don't know how I know that, but I do." "This is your secret." It wasn't a question. "Yes. Now, if only I knew what it meant." Roland looked around. Eddie followed his gaze and saw Susanna. He found some relief in the fact that Roland had heard her first. "What you boys doing up so late, chewing the fat?" She saw the wooden key in Eddie's hand and nodded. "I wondered when you were going to get around to showing that off. It's good, you know. I don't know what it's for, but it's damned good."
"You don't have any idea what door it might open?" Roland asked Eddie. "That was not part of your kef?"
"No. But it might be good for something, even though it isn't done." He held the key out to Roland. "I want you to keep it for me."
Roland didn't move to take it. He regarded Eddie closely.
"Why?"
"Because, well, because I think someone told me you should."
"Who?"
"Your boy," Eddie thought suddenly, and as soon as the thought came, he knew it was true. "It was your goddamned boy."
But he didn't want to say so. He didn't want to mention the boy's name at all. It might just set Roland off again.
"I don't know. But I think you ought to give it a try,"